Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And you know, you can listen to The Takeaway anytime by subscribing to our podcast. You can find it on our website, thetakeaway.org, or on iTunes. Hey, just another day at the office for a U.S. federal employee.
Every time you suit up, it's life or death. You roll the dice. And you deal with it.
A study shows how vulnerable government employees are to terrorists carrying bombs into federal buildings. More than a decade after Oklahoma City, we learned Timothy McVeigh wouldn't need a truck if he planned his attack for this week. Insecurity. Federal employees in the Hurt Locker. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. It's Thursday, July 9th, and we're taking a serious look at real insecurity for federal workers. Also, a look at commodities after oil, if we ever get there. Get out your pronouncers, folks. Also, escaping from traffic jams by magic. And Detroit, is there life after GM's bankruptcy? First, Mark Goldstein, you're the Director of Physical Infrastructure Issues at the U.S. Government Accountability Office. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning to you.
Now, you helped do this study on how federal buildings are vulnerable to smuggled-in bombs, and we love to exaggerate here on The Takeaway, but I'm suspecting that it's unfair to characterize being a federal employee as like being a bomb diffuser in the Hurt Locker, right?
I think that would be fair, yeah.
That's an exaggeration. Okay, but a serious question, how should federal employees feel knowing about this study, and we're going to talk about the details in a moment, going to work today?
Well, I think federal employees and anyone who goes into a federal building today ought to have some concern because there is no assurance that the people guarding these facilities are fully trained and fully can do their job, because the testing we did proved that there were serious deficiencies with securing federal property.
Wow, Mark Goldstein talking about serious deficiencies. We will get into the details of the study on security in federal buildings in just a moment. He's director of the Physical Infrastructure Program at the U.S. Government Accountability Office. Stay with us. The president, in the headlines, met with Brazil's leader today ahead of the wider G8 talks on emission standards. He says there's still time to close the gap on disagreements between industrialized and developing nations ahead of the big U.N. climate change meeting in Copenhagen in December. Also at the G8 meeting in Italy, President Obama says he'll hold a nuclear summit in Washington later this year, saying that nuclear terrorism is the most immediate threat to global security. Tomorrow, President Obama meets with the Pope and then heads to Ghana in sub-Saharan Africa. In the U.S., cash-strapped Los Angeles wants somebody to pick up the tab for the $1.4 million the city spent on the Michael Jackson Memorial, mostly in police overtime. Federal officials are checking in with states at an H1N1 flu summit today to tackle plans for an expected surge of flu cases this fall. And a spate of suicide bombings in Iraq has killed at least 40 people today. It's wounded dozens more. South Korean officials say its websites are again under cyber attack after a wave of attacks earlier this week. 7 sites in South Korea say they are under attack right now. And in about a half an hour, we'll get the latest info on the job market. New weekly jobless claims numbers in just a little while. The Dow opens at 8178. The S&P starts trading at 880. Looks like a bounce off the bottom when Wall Street opens in about an hour and a half. The NASDAQ begins at 1747. So, maybe you watched the Michael Jackson Memorial on a small screen over an internet line, looked at it as a download, a stream. We want to hear your stories of how you might have ditched your TV. TV's looking pretty retro these days. Post TV stories in the digital age at 877-8MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here, flying solo on the the Takeaway studios here in New York City. So as you could hear at the top of the hour, we referred to this disturbing report that the Government Accountability Office released to the press yesterday. Disturbing, certainly, to federal workers. It shows video and a report documenting that GAO investigators were a perfect 10 for 10 in smuggling bomb-making materials into different high-security federal buildings. In a post-9/11 in Oklahoma City world, it certainly shocked Senator Joe Lieberman of Connecticut.
It really is outrageously unacceptable that the federal employees working within our federal buildings and the citizens who pass through them are still apparently so utterly exposed to potential attack by terrorists or other violent people.
Well, we want to welcome back Mark Goldstein, Director of Physical Infrastructure Issues at the U.S. Department of General Accountability Office, who led this investigation. Also joining us is security strategist J.R. Roberts. He's a security strategist at J.R. Roberts Security Strategies. J.R. and Mark, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
First, Mark, let's continue our discussion. Describe the methodology of this study and what you were able to do. I said there at the top you were 10 for 10 in smuggling bomb-making materials. What kinds of things were you able to get into buildings?
Well, I'm not allowed to say exactly what we used because that information is classified, because we did bring in real bomb-making materials. Often tests that are done on buildings are done with fake materials, fake bombs, but that wasn't the case here. It was real live materials, and it was just done at a concentration level that the bombs would not have gone off for safety reasons. But the materials were real. We did bring them through security in all 10 federal buildings we tried to enter, and we took the materials into bathrooms and assembled the bombs and then walked freely around the offices of executive branch agencies as well as some field offices of U.S. legislature. As well.
Now, these were level four facilities, Homeland Security, Department of State. I believe Social Security Administration might have been a part of this as well.
These were all level four facilities, and the agencies of the Department of Homeland Security, Justice, State, Treasury, and Health and Human Services, and other organizations all had offices in the buildings that we visited.
And I don't want to do like a combat flashback here for America, but I remember one of the worst parts of the Murrow Building story in Oklahoma City back in the 90s was the fact that there was a federal daycare center in the facility. Were there daycare centers and child care centers in some of these federal facilities as well?
I don't want to describe the facilities too specifically, but there were certainly plenty of opportunity for the public in a variety of forms to come in and out because we chose buildings that had a great deal of public access.
Wow. Well, you can hear in the tone there Mark Goldstein being very responsible in hedging the way he talks about the facts of this report. J.R. Roberts, in general, when people hear conversations like this in the media, are we giving information to people? Are we encouraging them to carry out attacks by offering our disclosure of this vulnerability?
No, I don't think so. I think Mr. Goldstein was very careful in the way in which this process was conducted. I think he's right to withhold certain pieces of information. I guess the thing that surprises me the most is, out of this report is that we are surprised by the report. I think some of the challenges that exist are endemic within the system. I mean, you've got the FPS has a budget of almost $1 billion.
That's the Federal Protective Service that actually is responsible for security at all these buildings?
Yes, sir.
Right.
And as was pointed out, they have over 13,000 private contract security officers working. Now, that's reflective of 67 different companies. One sampling that Mr. Goldstein came up with that I thought was terrific was in looking just at one of those contractors, one of those private security contractors, and looking at 354 guards, 75% of them had expired certifications or no records of training.
Oh, that's...
And I think this cuts to the heart of it. I mean, this is endemic within the private security industry, you know, an industry that, by the way, has a greater turnover rate than the fast food industry.
Wow. Well, let me put that to Mark Goldstein. J.R. Roberts, who we were just talking with there, is a security strategist in Savannah, Georgia. Mark Goldstein, J.R. Roberts suggests that many, if not most, of the security personnel for federal buildings are subcontractors. They're not even under the full umbrella of the federal, federal employee net, whatever that is.
Well, the Federal Protective Service has a contract security guard force of 13,000 contract guards protecting about 2,500, 2,300 buildings of the 9,000 buildings in the government portfolio. But the problem is, because the Federal Protective Service itself is so stretched in the responsibilities that it has, what we found is their ability to oversee and supervise this contract guard force is not as good as it needs to be, and that the as a result, FPS had no assurance that guards were trained correctly and had certifications before they stood post at a federal facility. They had no complete assurance that once they were on post, that they were doing their job according to the responsibilities that they had. And then, of course, the part we've already talked about, there was no assurance that the buildings themselves were secure because we were able to penetrate every single building that we wanted to with bomb-making materials.
Now, J.R. Roberts, one of the things we discovered in the Murrow building attack in Oklahoma City was that here an utterly unimportant in terms of, you know, a national profile federal building that no one had heard of before this happened is suddenly made immortal by this horrible brutality. Even though these are level four facilities and there might not be gold bricks in them or, you know, cabinet secretaries to be taken hostage, although in this case there probably were, almost any federal facility of whatever security designation could be made this kind of terrorist symbol. Why is level four not level five, J.R. Roberts?
Well, there's no good reason why it shouldn't be. In other words, I mean, I think Mr. Goldstein pointed out another flaw in the system, and that is the FPS, again, the Federal Protective Services Administration, is stretched beyond belief. I also think it's a little disingenuous. You opened the show with a quote from Senator Lieberman, and I think it's a little disingenuous for Senator Lieberman to be running around wringing his hands saying he's shocked to discover that some of these people are inadequately trained, because part of the problem is the very agencies that are responsible or have the ability, our Congress that has the ability to really mandate national levels of training and then put teeth behind the ability to enforce those levels of training, are frankly conflicted by lobbying interests. I mean, Senator Lieberman received $53,500 last year from a single contract security firm, and I'm sure he's not alone. And I consider that to be a serious conflict of interest when we're trying to supervise these companies, many of whom, by the way, that are currently providing contract security services and are allowed to bid for these services, many of whom have been cited by state agencies repeatedly for the very kinds of violations that Mr. Goldstein confirmed, a failure to hire adequately, a failure to train. I've got numerous cases all over the country where I'm dealing with private security firms that hired known felons, and then a tragedy occurred.
All right, J.R. Roberts, before we go, I want to bring it back to Mark Goldstein, who is actually the director of physical infrastructure issues at the Government Accountability Office, and I guess will be somewhat involved in the fix here. Is this another design question where we've become kind of top-heavy in security in the United States, where we got lots of great satellites and lots of planners and maybe all kinds of electronic equipment, but not enough boots on the ground, even in our own country, even in our own federal buildings, Mark Goldstein?
Well, I think there's no substitute for an effectively trained and certified and supervised workforce that has the best ability, probably more than technology can, to be able to affect security in federal buildings. One of the reasons why some of the examples that we brought up in our report occurred is because the guards were not fully trained. They were not at their post doing their work all the time. They were not looking, for instance, at the X-ray machines as materials went through in some cases. And so there is no substitute for an effectively trained workforce that's supervised. And that, in I think our opinion, is the biggest issue, is to making sure that the management and supervision of this program can be improved. Sure, there are resource issues and issues of maybe people having too much to do in some instances and being stretched thin, but at the end of the day, a better managed workforce would help.
Let's leave people with a resource issue before we go. You talked about the cost of training, and the Congress will have to deal with that. In your experiment in trying to smuggle bombs, how much did the materials cost to get these bombs through right.
These were made with ordinary, relatively ordinary materials that could be purchased for
how much?
$150.
$150. Well, there's your takeaway. Mark Goldstein, Director of Physical Infrastructure Issues at the U.S. Government Accountability Office, and J.R. Roberts, Security Strategist at J.R. Roberts Security Strategies. Thanks so much, guys.
Sure. Thank you, Ben.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Huckenberry. So markets are poised to open positively this morning, but commodities prices are in the doldrums. Oil prices are hovering around $60 a barrel. They peaked above $61 this morning, but it's been a drop of 17% since last week, an enormous drop in the price of oil. And you know, we talk a lot about commodities prices, and particularly oil prices, and for 1,000 years, the commodities we've been concerned with were wood and coal. Oil came in about 100 years ago. Copper was really important if you're building things. But if we get away from oil, if we ever do, in the 21st century, carbon-based commodities will not be what we pay attention to. They're going to be other sorts of industrial age, 21st century commodities that we need to look at. And because it's something we're going to be dealing with for the next 200 or 300 years, Lisa Marganelli is here with us to sort it out. She's a regular Takeaway contributor who writes the energy blog for The Atlantic. She's the author of Oil on the Brain. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning.
We often talk to you about oil, but today we're not going to talk to you about oil so much, although this story is all about humankind's attempts to get off oil, but we've created more problems for ourselves, right?
Right.
So explain the products that we're developing to get us off oil and the new problems that we're developing.
Well, I think one of the things is, you know, we all love Prius cars. And what we don't realize is that in not using oil, they use and they make use of another element called neodymium. It's a rare earth metal. And neodymium is used in the little motors that run the Prius. It's also used in basically every new car these days. All the little motors that run your power windows up and down are all neodymium. Neodymium, it makes permanent magnets, very, very lightweight permanent magnets.
And you need these magnets to run the electric motor that turns the wheels
right.
in the engines. And you don't need that much of it because, you know, neodymium is a lot like something from this Disney movie here.
Dust.
Dust?
Dust.
Yup. Just a little bit of pixie dust.
I mean, Lisa, we checked. It actually looks like pixie dust, neodymium, right?
It does. It does. I got to see some of it, and the ore is actually kind of a violet color, sometimes a little bit rose, sometimes gray, but it's this eerie sort of very, very fine powder. Before it's then turned into a metal or a magnet.
All right, so what's the problem with neodymium? Is it hard to get? Does it create problems when you mine it? Is it rare? What's the deal?
It's called a rare earth metal. In fact, rare earth metals are not all that rare. What is rare is to find deposits of them that are easy to get out of the ground and that are not filled with all sorts of radioactive byproducts like thorium. So there was a deposit in the U.S. that was mined from the 40s onward. And up until the early 90s, it produced basically all of the world's neodymium. It's called Mountain Pass. It's in California. And then gradually, China opened up its own deposits of neodymium and took over the market. They were producing it much more cheaply than the U.S. was. Neodymium is pretty hard to produce in the U.S. You have to have a lot of environmental safeguards on it, obviously, just to run a mine and then to deal with what radioactivity there is around it. What has happened is that China now controls maybe 98-99% of the world's supply of neodymium. And this U.S. mine is gradually coming back online. But one of the things that analysts say is, look, if we want to have more electric cars, more hybrid cars, we're going to need more neodymium. And we have to ask ourselves whether we're trading a dependence upon oil, that where we're dependent upon basically 160 different kinds of crude oil from around the world,
right,
to neodymium that's available basically from one or two places on Earth.
All right, so there's a price issue here, because as the demand goes up and if the supply is, as you say, restricted, you know, we're back in the same problem of, you know, $140 a barrel oil. The price is just going to spike and we aren't going to get any sort of cost savings. But it sounds to me there's very little that's green about getting neodymium.
It depends. You know, mines are not inherently green. And and, you know, in the U.S., we don't want the mines in our backyard.
Right.
But the question is that it all comes from somebody's backyard. And so this is coming from someone in China's backyard where there are fewer environmental controls.
What's the potential for recycling rare earths and, you know, these 21st century minerals like neodymium?
I think it's very high. In fact, you know, as we go into these, you know, new types of cars and things, we're going to have a whole range of strategic minerals that we're dealing with, including, for example, cobalt that's used in the batteries, lithium that's in, you know, there's big supplies of lithium around the world in different places. But we're going to want to conserve all of these minerals. There's coltan in our cell phones. All of these things come from areas that to some extent may have conflict around them now or could in the future. We're going to need to think about how we recycle the car even before we build it.
Right.
We're going to need to keep that stuff circulating. So you'd want to think about who owns it. You know, right now, batteries are a commodity. You buy them really cheaply and you throw them away. But what if we said, okay, you know, the auto company owns your battery and they need to take it back when it's done and they need to recycle it. Does that change the kind of minerals that they use? Does that change the price point at which they can provide the battery? Does that change the whole economy of the batteries and whether or not we have a battery industry in the U.S.? All of this stuff, we need to start rethinking how we really supply and use and recycle these minerals, because we can't just think of sending them to the landfill.
And just imagine in the future on the Wall Street Journal, you know, page, if it even exists, will be neodymium futures. Who knows? We'll be able to trade those. So Lisa Marganelli, regular contributor, writes an energy blog for The Atlantic. Her book is Oil on the Brain. Maybe your sequel should be Neodymium on the Brain. Thanks, Lisa.
Thanks.
Some good ideas from the takeaway there. And now Mark Garrison has the headlines.
Try to share wisdom when we can.
Yes, we do.
John, 28 minutes after the hour. A lot of news coming out of the G8, where President Obama and others are. The UN's boss says the group isn't doing enough on climate change. Ban Ki-moon says rich countries need to give more support to developing nations so they can cut pollution. The new comments come after mixed results in climate talks so far. Leaders made no hard commitments to help fund greenhouse gas reductions in developing countries. More talks going on today on climate as well as the economy. President Obama is also making news there on nuclear issues. He's now talking about new plans for hosting a nuclear security summit with dozens of nations early next year. Over in Los Angeles, the Getty Museum is now safe after a close call with a rough fire there. The blaze is now 90% contained. Firefighters say it started with sparks from weed whackers. And South Korea now under a cyber attack, a new one much like the ones that crippled the U.S. and South Korean sites recently. The government says multiple websites are getting fresh attacks. South Korean intelligence points the finger at North Korea. Also, multiple bombings in Iraq have killed dozens today. Dual suicide bombers struck in the north. Roadside bombs also exploded in the Baghdad area. And dozens dead in Afghanistan after a massive truck bomb strike. Several children among the dead. The explosion was in the middle of the country. That is some of the headlines we have right now. John, I think you're monitoring the takeaway GPS navigation device
yes,
to tell
indeed.
Us where we're going
and,
next.
If you're sitting in your car, all right, in traffic, along with millions of others around the country, you do have the option of public transit. That might be the way to go. A new study from the Texas Transportation Institute showed that public transportation saves commuters millions of hours in travel each year. We'll get the details in just a minute.
To the traffic light.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Oh, sorry. Did I catch you at a bad time? Some of you out there stuck in traffic, trapped in your car, looking at brake lights. Well, what if you could magically just stop your car, open your door, and step into a train? A train that would whisk you free of all the traffic and straight to your destination. Well, public transit is hardly new. And taking public transit in 2007 magically saved 646 million hours in travel time and also 389 million gallons of gasoline. That was in 2007. In 2008, gas prices spiked. The trend may even be bigger in 08 and 09. Joining us now is Tim Lomax, a research engineer with the Texas Transportation Institute, who co-authored this study on what public transit has saved commuters as recently as 2007. Tim Lomax, good morning.
Good morning.
So, I mean, obviously, more people using public transit reduces the number of people commuting. But what lesson does this offer in the latest study about how much of a cost savings and an energy savings public transit amounts to?
Well, I think we're really looking at a pretty significant savings, particularly in the areas where if you care about congestion, you really need it the most, because that's where public transportation really comes into play. Big, dense activity centers like Manhattan, there's no way you could economically sustain that without public transportation. So maybe one of the lessons isn't really even in our study. It's just that beyond transportation, just to the economy, that's the importance of public transportation. It allows big economic engines to exist.
Well, Tim, you know, I'm always saying to myself, I don't know about you, you know, what would I do if I had an extra 646 million hours, you know, in my life? Where do people mostly save that time? In what part of the country?
Well, the Northeast and the Midwest, where the major public transit systems are and where most of the congestion is. But there's also a pretty substantial savings in places like Portland, Seattle, Los Angeles, areas that have either a lot of congestion, which is Los Angeles, or commitments to public transit, both from a system standpoint but also from a land use perspective.
Now, do you see with the deteriorating economy plus the oil and gas price spikes of 2008, a combination, do you see those two phenomena together as increasing this trend as you're going to look at statistics for 08 and 09?
Well, I think what the gas price run-ups have done is cause people to think about how they're moving around, how they get back and forth to work or other destinations. So there may be more people who say, you know, I may not be able to take public transit all the time, or I may need to, you know, have sales calls or whatever. But there's some days where it would really pay me to take transit, to consider it as a 1 or 2 day a week event. And I think that's really where we are in terms of addressing the mobility problems. There's a whole lot more options out there, maybe than people consider. I think there's sometimes people get stuck in a rut, and the gas price has allowed them to think more broadly about their options.
Well, if you multiply 398 million gallons of gas times $3 a gallon or more, I mean, you know, it's
a really big number.
Huge number. And I guess the question for me is, how come these kinds of statistics don't motivate governments and, you know, planners to basically organize programs to capture these savings by increasing the capacity of public transit, of making sure that this moment isn't lost, that this influx of people who are using public transit actually get the benefit of increased cars, increased trackage, more modernized trains, new destinations?
Well, it's a pretty complicated issue. I think really what we've seen on the transportation side is it's not just about transportation. It's about transportation as a priority against lots of other elements in society. A lot of investments are needed in schools and libraries and police and fire protection.
Well, that's fine. So, okay, that's fine. But what about just purely looking at it in terms of the competition between infrastructure for cars and infrastructure for public transit? Couldn't we rebalance that equation? And wouldn't the stimulus money be directed at public transit based on these numbers right here?
Well, I think really what you need is a land land use pattern and a set of governmental regulations that promote public transit probably more so than they do now. If you think about the way the tax laws and the land, most of the land use regulations, they're not really designed to get as many people out of their cars as possible. It really, I mean, some level this is a democracy. People are making different choices. But there's also a fairly well established suburban development program. You know, we're building houses out in the suburbs because they cost less, and so public transit, I think, has an important niche, and I think that's really maybe what you're driving at here.
Well, I guess
it's not for everybody, but it is for some people.
I guess the sad thing for me is with all the work that you've done at the Texas Transportation Institute, I don't see any bullet trains between Dallas and Houston or Austin.
We have interstates, and people like to drive on those interstates. I think there is more discussion now about high-speed rail in Texas and lots of other places. I think with some of the stimulus money, there's been more activity on that front. I think some level you got to align the incentives. Right now, airlines compete pretty well in that market, and it would be difficult to set up a government program that could compete with the airlines.
It's tough to compete with the airlines in Texas. Well, Tim Lomax, thanks so much. Tim Lomax is a research engineer with the Texas Transportation Institute, co-author of a study which found that in 2007, commuters saved 398 million gallons of gasoline by using public transportation. Mark Garrison has our headlines now.
Thank you, John. 21 minutes before the hour, we just have some fresh numbers just out a few minutes ago. New weekly jobless claims have dropped pretty sharply to 565,000. That's still a lot, but it's well below what analysts predicted. And again, so that the number of people filing new claims for unemployment support, that went down and down a lot further than what analysts were thinking it was doing. So we'll be watching that and unfolding as that goes this morning. President Obama is at the G8 right now. Today, several leading developing nations are part of the conversation on topics including climate change and the economy. Looking ahead, the president meets with Pope Benedict at the Vatican tomorrow. He also heads to Ghana in West Africa. Iran's government promises to crush any election protests today. Demonstrators planned a rally to mark the anniversary of clashes between students and security forces a decade ago. Election protests have dwindled since a government crackdown on demonstrators recently. There's a summit this morning on the H1N1 virus, commonly known as swine flu. U.S. federal and state officials are looking into ways to prepare for the upcoming flu season. Those are headlines for the moment. John, what else is coming up this hour?
Markets are loving, the futures traders are loving the jobs number there. But what we have coming up, General Motors may emerge from bankruptcy any day now. What will the new GM look like? What are the people of Detroit thinking? Still ahead on The Takeaway, community leaders in Detroit take the pulse of the city.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. So the situation in Iran is gone from the headlines, but it's still unfolding there. Protesters have planned a rally early this evening on an important anniversary to talk about the election that took place last month. Michael Slackman, New York Times Middle East bureau chief, joins us now from Cairo, Egypt. The dispute over the election that has at least officially returned President Ahmadinejad to power is still under dispute on the streets of Tehran. What are you seeing, Michael?
Well, much more than just on the streets, also behind the scenes. There are a lot of power centers in the factionalized power system of Iran that are continuing to contest the elections. Today, we're kind of in a standby mode because, as you said, there are plans for demonstrations to mark the 10th anniversary of a very bloody conflict between police and students that occurred in Tehran. There has been talk of something like 200 cities around the nation having protests, but there's also been a very strong government response, which they have said the protests would be illegal and would be crushed. So we're waiting to see.
Let's talk about this 10th anniversary for a moment. If I'm not mistaken, that was during the era of President Khatibeh, right?
Mm-hmm. There, at the time, the students had been protesting the shutting of a reformist newspaper. And if you recall, President Khatami, for all of his reformist credentials and his effort to ease up and modernize the nation, was thwarted at almost every turn by the hardline clerics, who actually now are, not just clerics, I should point out, but the hardline military forces
sure.
that are there, who are now in power, who've now actually consolidated power.
So an additional engine for this, or a narrative engine for this demonstration is, in addition to disputing the results of the most recent election, it's also a suggestion that the students today don't want it to end up the way it ended up 10 years ago.
Well, I think that's fair. I think that's a fair assessment. But if there is a protest, it's about this election.
Right.
It's about the election and the direction that people feel the country is going.
And behind the scenes, what's going on?
Well, that's harder to ascertain. I mean, we see smoke signals coming up out every now and then. Influential clerics, some of the most influential clerics, founders of the revolution who worked very closely with Ayatollah Khomeini to create this blended theocracy and democracy, very much opposed to what happened, condemning it. And perhaps more telling, there are some hardline clerics who are generally very supportive of the government who've remained quiet. This isn't over, but it also isn't necessarily, there's not going to be a strike, a thunderclap or a lightning strike. It's going to be playing out slowly behind the scenes, and I would think for a long time to come.
And certainly this election has taught the rest of the world about the inner workings of the clergy in Iran. For so long, we've simply talked about various nuanced moderates, but the clergy was a monolith. That's no longer the case.
You know, I think if there is a silver lining to this crisis that has beleaguered a whole nation in the Middle East, in Iran, it's that I think the world now sees Iran really more clearly for what it is, which is a very diverse place. It is certainly not monolithic at any level. It's greatly factionalized. It has a great degree of diversity.
Oh, that's a very interesting point. Michael Slackman, New York Times Middle East Bureau Chief. I noticed your byline this morning is with Alan Cowell. Say hello to my good friend Alan Cowell, will you?
I'll do that.
All right, Michael Slackman, New York Times Middle East Bureau Chief, talking about the situation continuing to unfold, if not in the headlines, certainly in Iran, the dispute over the June 12th election.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Detroiters think about life after GM or after GM bankruptcy when we have headlines, right after headlines with Mark Garrison.
Thank you, John. Coming up on 12 minutes before the hour, President Obama met with Brazil's leader today ahead of wider G8 talks on emission standards. World leaders are also talking about the economy. Tomorrow, President Obama meets with the Pope at the Vatican, then heads to Ghana in West Africa. In the U.S., officials in L.A. want someone to pick up the bill or at least help for the $1.4 million the city spent on security for the Michael Jackson Memorial. Most of that was in police overtime. The city did set up an online donation site, but it's had a lot of technical glitches and not a lot of money they've taken in so far. Pakistan's prime minister says the some 2 million people who fled an army offensive against the Taliban in the Swat Valley will be allowed to return home next week. The prime minister said today that electricity and water networks have been repaired in towns in the region, and Afghan officials say at least 25 people, many of them school children, have died in a roadside explosion outside of Kabul. John?
Thank you, Mark. So you report on this all the time. Everywhere you look, it's history in the auto industry. A new General Motors is supposedly going to emerge from bankruptcy, right? Any day now, right?
Deadline
You'll bring
is tomorrow,
it to us live when it happens. Yeah, certainly.
Could happen today. Yeah, they got to do it by midnight.
Changes in the auto industry for most of the last century are very close at hand. I mean, think of it. In 1956, if you heard a Buick commercial, the tone of the voice was almost reverential.
Here is the most eager performer on the road. Whatever you ask of it, your new Buick will give you smoothly and in spades. Prove it for yourself at your Buick dealer.
But then last month, here's President Obama making a Buick joke.
Like the taut, athletic design of the new Buick Enclave. Its French-themed leather and warm wood tones make the enclave more than transportation. It's a modern driver's retreat. Come on, work with me here.
President of the United States and auto executive, we should point out, Barack Obama. Taxpayers own most of the new GM when it emerges from bankruptcy. But the people of Detroit have gotten beyond this already. They're already rubbing their eyes and wondering what the future is post-auto industry, or post the auto industry as we've known it, for the city of Detroit. Joining us is Bishop Charles Ellis of the Greater Grace Temple in Detroit, and Noah Ofshinsky, a reporter with WDET. Our partners there in the Detroit city. Bishop and Noah, good morning.
Good morning, John.
Noah, let's begin with you. What's the sense of people in Detroit? Are they beyond this issue of GM emerging from bankruptcy, and have they already moved on to some extent?
I'm not sure they're beyond it. I think people want to know what the bottom is, and if we've hit the bottom, and if this bankruptcy is the bottom, where do we go from here? I think people want to know that the slide is done, and that we can only go up from here. And I think that's the big question on a lot of people's mind here, especially in Southeast Michigan.
So, Bishop Ellis, people sliding down and looking to move up again, that's a good subject for a sermon, I have a feeling.
That sounds like something that we'll preach, but I think that if people have come to grips with the auto industry being remade or retooled and being reconstructed, and I think that they've come to grips with the fact that there are no more guarantees, that you're not guaranteed a job in the auto plant if you're not doing well educationally. I think that they have come to grips with the fact that they're going to have to retool themselves, and they're going to have to reposition themselves and look for other opportunities beyond the auto industry.
So, Bishop Charles Ellis, is this an opportunity for you as a preacher to really look maybe a little more deeply into the hearts of your parishioners?
I think that my job and my calling is to continue to preach a message of hope. First of all, our hope should never be in things of this world, because they come and they go. Our hope should be in God, but I believe also naturally that people should be looking at, again, repositioning themselves and dealing with the realities of what's going on. The reality is that the automobile industry will never, ever, ever be the same again. There are no more givens within the automobile industry, but the reality of it is that you can now move towards something else. I believe that God has given all of us various gifts and talents, and I see a lot of people moving into their passions, entrepreneurial things and visions and dreams, and because they were stable in the automobile industry, they never stepped out on those other things that they had burning within them. But now they are doing that, and they're finding that there is life beyond the automobile industry.
Noah Ofshinsky, if I'm not mistaken, and I've done some reporting in your neck of the woods and on the auto industry, your grandfather holds a patent for electric car batteries. Am I right about that?
Yes, he owns a few patents, and they generally enable the technology that's been used in hybrid batteries in some of the cars that have come out of Japan. He's also done a lot of work in solar energy as well.
Now, is this whole thing that's going on in Detroit a kind of a huge I told you so moment for him, your grandpa?
Ooh, I don't know. Maybe I should plead the fifth on that one. But yes, I think he would say that. But I'm going to go on a limb for you, John. I think he had some of these warnings several years ago, both about GM and other companies, and that what he said was going to happen is now coming to pass.
And we should remind people, I mean, your granddaddy's story is really a story about how there are pockets of industrial genius in Detroit that are still there, that are well beyond the auto industry, that don't need GM to move forward. Is that fair, Bishop Charles Ellis?
Well, I think that the governor has tried to make a bit of a transition, especially here in Southeast Michigan, to Detroit being the midway movie capital, the midway Hollywood. She's offering all kinds of tax incentives for movie producers and that industry to come to Southeast Michigan and to find itself a home in the midway. The movie Gran Torino, Clint Eastwood,
right,
was probably the most notable movie that was filmed right here in the Detroit area, right next door at in Highland Park. And I believe that we're seeing now some other industries. And, of course, there's this green movement that is going on. And I believe that Michigan, with wind turbine and electric batteries for the alternative cars and all of that, is finding itself a home right here in Southeast Michigan.
You certainly had to stay tuned for the entire movie of Gran Torino to find a hopeful message, though, there in Michigan. Here, a friend of the Takeaway, Will Markham, who's a GM worker, also has a hopeful message. Listen to this, guys.
Oh, I believe we're going to survive it. I've already seen the resiliency. People are looking for other jobs, getting involved in other businesses, understanding that there is, you know, they may not have the job security they once had with General Motors, so they're looking for other alternatives.
Noah Ovshinsky, how difficult is it to find those alternatives? Bishop Charles Ellis just suggested a couple a moment ago.
Very difficult. Yes, there have been some investments in green energy. Yes, the movie industry is certainly good for the morale of the state. I'm not sure what impact it's had really economically, but it's certainly good for the morale. For those who can, I know a lot of people who have left the state. We have a great university system, but when people go, if you're out of state or from the state, you leave. And so I think the brain drain is an issue. So one response is people are simply picking up and leaving the state.
Mm-hmm.
The other response, of course, is to retrain themselves. And there are incentives in place and programs here in Michigan, state-sponsored and otherwise, to help people retool themselves for the new economy.
Bishop Charles Ellis, is it true that your parishioners for a 50-year young birthday gave you a Cadillac SUV seat?
No, that was one individual
who
worked for a tier supplier of the automobile industry.
And it's kind of an office chair?
Yes.
That says something about retooling the auto industry right there, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely, because actually, if you plug it in, all of the electronics work on it, and the moving parts work.
In the winter, that heat seat is going to be useful, right?
Seat
heater.
Absolutely, cut down on the heating bill there.
Green energy. Use your Cadillac Escalade seat in your office. Bishop Charles Ellis, Greater Grace Temple in Detroit, and Noah Ovshinsky, reporter for WDET. Thanks to both of you for being on the program. And Noah, be sure to say hi to your granddaddy for me. So on The Takeaway, we've got you thinking about this: abandoning your television and watching events online. It's more and more possible these days, and here's what one of you had to say. Gary writes to us, "Nope, not me. I'm a dinosaur in a digital age. I still watch TV shows on TV, especially since we just got a new widescreen TV with the advent of all the on-demand channels, but I watch YouTube videos on the computer as well as selected news events. I try to keep both mediums separate." Well, we should check back in with Gary to find out how he's doing in 5 years. They may not be so separate. Tell us which screen you prefer at 877-8MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. And here is your takeaway.
The problem is, because the Federal Protective Service itself is so stretched in the responsibilities that it has, what we found is their ability to oversee and supervise this contract guard force is not as good as it needs to be.
That's Mark Goldstein, Director of Physical Infrastructure Issues at the U.S. Government Accountability Office. He joined us earlier to talk about how easy it was to smuggle bomb-making materials into high-security federal buildings. Yikes. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Hey, everybody, we are thrilled to be here in Italy tonight. First, I'd like to introduce the members of the band, though. We've got Nicholas Sarkozy on guitar, Silvio Berlusconi on tenor sax, Angela Merkel of Germany on drums, horn section, Dmitry Medvedev, Taro Asso, and Gordon Brown, Canada's Stevie Harper on cowbell and backup vocals, and on bass, from Chicago, Illinois, Barack Obama. Ladies and gentlemen, live from L'Aquila, Italy, it's the G8.
Girl, ever since you put me down,
The real G8 leaders aren't as together as the Junior Wells Band. They are literally in an earthquake zone and can't find much to agree on, particularly climate change, their supposed main focus. Conducting the G8 Band, we've got a backstage pass on The Takeaway. Ever since you
put me down. All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Oh, good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry, and I'm on solid ground this Thursday, July 9th. We're talking about cutting emissions diplomatically at the G8. And then it's on to cutting the cable. Are you dropping the cable box but keeping the webcast? More fallout from the Blagojevich scandal. Who's next in the indictment line? And is the new Harry Potter movie a tween flick or a film for the diehard fans? Those stories coming up. But first, the headlines. In the headlines, in the past few minutes, new numbers on retail sales and jobless claims. As the markets watch, consumer confidence in the U.S. figures just out show retail sales dropping sharply for many merchants last month. Weakness seems to cut across all sectors, though clothes sales were especially affected. On jobs mixed news, new claims for jobless benefits dropped last week to the lowest numbers since January, but that might just be due to the timings of auto layoffs. 565,000 people filed for the benefits last week. In Italy at the G8 summit, the president has met with Brazil's leader ahead of the wider G8 talks on emission standards, which we're going to talk about in a minute. He said there's still time to close the gap on disagreements between industrialized and developing nations before the big UN climate change meeting in Copenhagen in December. But let's talk to Richard Gowan now. Richard is Associate Director at New York University's Center on International Cooperation. You're following the G8 meeting, right, Richard?
Yep.
They're having difficulty agreeing on climate change. It has fairly major implications for the world, wouldn't you say?
Negotiations are difficult, but I think that Barack Obama is having a much, much easier ride and a much better reception than George Bush did at any G8. And so negotiations may not look great, but the process is still going reasonably well.
Well, if the comparison is to George W. Bush, the bar is pretty low there. We're going to talk about the details and the implications for climate change, particularly that divide, in just a moment. Richard Gowan, stay with us. Also at the G8, President Obama says he'll hold a nuclear security summit in Washington next year. Now moving on to Iran. Iran says the U.S. has handed over five of its officials to Iraqi authorities after they'd been held for more than 2 years. Back in the U.S., it could be out with the old and in with the new at GM today. That deal to close the restructuring of GM could close as early as today. The Dow opens at 8178. The S&P starts trading at 880 and the NASDAQ at 1747. The future of TV. TV's looking pretty retro in the digital age. Tell us your story. Have you given up TV or are you staying with traditional small screen entertainment? 877-8MYTAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry, flying solo here on The Takeaway. We open the hour with Standing on Shaky Ground, Junior Wells' famous tune. And that's what they're doing, literally, over in L'Aquila, Italy, where the G8 are gathered, and they're not making beautiful music together. The leaders meeting in Italy are trying to come to agreement on new targets for battling global warming. They're trying to find a goal of keeping the world's average temperature from rising more than 2 degrees Celsius. But perhaps the most important issue and the most divisive issue for the leaders was posed by the Indian Prime Minister, Manmohan Singh, who said that poorer countries maybe have a role in reducing climate change, but they don't want to suffer.
As responsible members of the international community, we recognize our obligation to preserve and protect our environment. But climate change cannot be addressed by perpetuating the poverty of the developing countries.
Similar sentiments have been expressed by China and Brazil. India, China, and Brazil are not members of the G8, but they are at the summit. Joining us now from L'Aquila, Italy, is Peter Baker, our partner of the New York Times. He's the correspondent there covering the G8 summit. Good morning, Peter.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, and it seems to me that while it's all friendly and smiles there, there's not a lot of agreement in L'Aquila. What would you say the track record is of points of common ground at this point?
You know, these G8 summits are filled with lots of pre-cooked statements on things that nobody would disagree with, right? They're all, they'd like to see Middle East peace, they'd like to not have nuclear weapons spread everywhere, they'd like better health around the world. But the real point of contention this summit so far has been on climate change. What is the solution to the emissions of these greenhouse gases around the world? And the big divide is between the industrial countries like the United States, England, France, and so forth, and the developing countries like China, India, Brazil. And yesterday and today, the developing countries said, well, we agree climate change is a problem. We agree we're going to try to do something about it. We don't agree with the specific targets that you want to impose on us.
Well, Peter, is that an argument to make the G8 the G11, to bring Brazil, India, and China into it? Or is it more of an argument to create something new called the C4, Climate 4? And I use that C4 analogy deliberately. It's also the name of a plastic explosive. To have the United States, China, Brazil, and India together in some group on their own.
Yeah, you can have the C4, you can have the B8, you can have the G, you know, the Z12. I mean, the thing is that these sort of distinctions are increasingly irrelevant. I think the G8 these days is more and more marginalized compared to, let's say, the G20. That's the larger group that met in London in April, talked about the world recession, and then we'll meet again in Pittsburgh in September. Because of the broader group, that it does include influential powers like China and India that are not members of the G8, it may be increasingly the wave of the future.
All right, well, I want to stay on the line with us, Peter Baker from The New York Times, who's in L'Aquila, Italy, live for us. I want to get a sense of what's happening today and tomorrow. But continuing with us now is Richard Gowan, Associate Director at New York University's Center on International Cooperation. This is an interesting divide. The G8, and particularly China and the United States, that's another group, and then this China-Brazil-India group. The disagreement among these various groups is proving to be pretty difficult, wouldn't you say, Richard?
But it's entirely predictable because it comes down to the simplest thing in politics, which is who pays. The question is, are developed countries going to take on the burden of paying for dealing with climate change, or can some of that cost be moved on to developing economies like India, which are, as their economies grow, creating huge amounts of carbon emissions? The G8 Western countries say we're prepared to cut our carbon emissions by 80% by 2050, but we want the developing countries to cut their emissions by 50%. Now, that sounds like a good deal, but the developing countries say no. In terms of our efforts to end poverty, in terms of our efforts to become rich Western-style countries, those things aren't compatible, and you're asking us to pay the price for your development in the past.
Yet, Richard, they're not just saying no in these countries. They're also saying quite specifically to Barack Obama, well, hey, look at your climate bill in Congress. It's not even remotely as ambitious as what you're suggesting here at the G8 summit.
Everyone is playing to domestic audiences, but I don't think you should underestimate the extent to which people are seized of the fact that President Obama wants some progress on this issue. And you've got to remember that this is a very, very elongated process. There's another summit bringing together all the world's leaders on climate change here in New York in September that's going to be convened by the UN. And then at the very end of the year, there's a summit in Copenhagen, which is where all these deals are meant to be wrapped up. Now, if you're the Indians or you're the French or you're the Americans, you're not going to show all your cards now. You're not going to do all the deal making now because you've got another 6 months of negotiations ahead of you. So right now, everyone is posturing. Everything is pretty declaratory. What they're actually talking about is keeping temperatures at 2% higher, 2 degrees Celsius higher than they were before the Industrial Revolution, which is before the United States existed.
Right.
That's an astonishing declaratory goal, but it's not the hard stuff of negotiation. The hard stuff of negotiation is coming later in the year.
Well, the hard stuff, and what I want to talk about in just a moment, is whether there is enough international governance infrastructure to actually make this work. You've got the G8, you've got the United Nations, and you've got other international governance bodies. I want to talk about that in a moment. But Peter really raises the central point, and that is whether we're talking G8, G20, the entire General Assembly or the Security Council, is there a governing institution in world government right now capable of mediating the tough challenges of climate change that involve money, security, and domestic economies?
There is no single institution that can do that, and for the reasons that Peter was saying, the G8 is actually pretty badly placed to do that. It's especially badly placed to do that because Italy, as the chair, has been really very incompetent in putting this summit together. The Italian diplomatic service, Silvio Berlusconi, who has his personal problems, have made a bit of a hash of getting this summit together. But what happened when the US realized that there were problems on the horizon, the US stepped in, and actually it's been Washington that's been driving the agenda in Italy, not only on climate change, but also on food security, which is something they'll discuss tomorrow. And at the end of the day, it's not about the number of institutions or the shape of the institutions, it's about will big powers agree? And the first thing you need to get any sort of agreement still, despite the fact that the US is not the superpower it seemed to be 10 years ago, is U.S. momentum, and we have that for the first time in a decade.
Peter Baker, before we go, Barack Obama didn't appear to have a whole lot of clout in Moscow earlier in the week. He's been received around the world as a rock star in his various foreign appearances since inauguration. What do you make of his clout at this G8 summit in L'Aquila?
Well, I think he has a good deal of sway here. He's the new kid on the block compared to the other leaders. But on the other hand, they recognize that he is coming in with a mandate from the American public and that he is closer to them, both in tone and in substance and a lot of the things that they care about. The other thing, though, that's important to remember is that that initial burst of enthusiasm for Obama, the rock star kind of reception, I think is beginning to give way a little bit to the old and enduring truth that American interests are not always the same as other countries' interests, and they're just not necessarily the same as America's. And that's going to be true whether it's a Democrat in the White House or a Republican in the White House. I mean, in the end, for instance, America is still looking to build this missile defense system in Eastern Europe that is a big problem with Russia. Obama has not abandoned that.
Right.
He is reviewing it. But he cares very much about stopping Iran from having a nuclear weapon. He cares, obviously, has to worry about North Korea having nuclear weapons. He supports both Israel and a Palestinian state. A lot of these things are somewhat consistent, pretty consistent, actually, with the second term of President Bush and a lot of previous presidents. And I think that those, you know, he would like Europeans, for instance, to send more troops to Afghanistan. They still don't want to do that. That hasn't changed just because they like Obama better.
Well, and those are the subjects of bilateral discussions that will no doubt be taking place today. Peter, before we go, we assembled a band of the G8. You didn't hear it at the top of the hour. We had Barack Obama playing bass. Would you agree with that? I'd say bass.
I think he has a good bass.
What about Angela Merkel? Angela Merkel on drums, right?
Angela Merkel on drums.
Sarkozy guitar.
I want to hear Berlusconi sing.
All right, let's do that. Peter Baker, New York Times correspondent, L'Aquila, Italy, covering the G8 Live. Also, Richard Gowan, associate director at New York University's Center on International Cooperation. We're on solid ground. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry, and I'm looking at this. I mean, guys, I need to get producer Jim Colgan on the line. Colgan?
John.
Colgan, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Jim, sorry to wake you up, but I just want to figure something out about this next segment. So you haven't had any kind of phone landline for years, right?
That's right.
We know that about you. I mean, you're kind of a techie and all that. You broadcast TV, that's gone, right?
It's gone. None of this that. Year.
Most of your communication is always by internet, Google Phone, or Vonage, right? Something like that?
Yeah, Google Phone, now Skype.
So now you want me to believe that you're getting rid of your cable box and basically your whole TV setup altogether?
It's gone. I got rid of it. I got rid of my TV. I put it in storage.
And you can still watch the same stuff? No cable, no TV needed?
I'm watching it all on Hulu and on live streaming, and I think I'm totally managing.
You still have your cat, right?
I still have my cat, yeah.
You still have your cat. No internet version of your kitty cat, right?
I mean, there are, but it's kind of...
That's for another segment. Thank you, Jim.
Yeah.
The sounds all over America of people... Well, maybe not smashing their TVs, but moving from TV to something else. The Michael Jackson Memorial event was watched online by a sizable, measurable audience. Suddenly, the traditional TV pipeline looks a little retro. Kevin Purdy is the senior editor of lifehacker.com. He joins us from Rochester, New York, at PRI station WXXI. Kevin Purdy, good morning.
Good morning.
So, Kevin, let's talk tech for a second, obviously. I mean, the experience of our producer, Jim Colgan, is, one person's experience. But technically, watching video on the computer, and the Michael Jackson Memorial really proves it, is not about bad resolution, fuzzy video anymore, is it?
No, I would say not.
And so what are the sort of technical issues that allow you to watch the same programs online as you've been able to do on cable or broadcast?
I think just widespread broadband pretty much everywhere you go, every office you're in and at home, if you've got a cable or, even a better fiber optic Fios connection, it's pretty on par with watching, let's say, older pre-HD TV. During the Obama inauguration, I think I was switching between my TV on CNN and my computer, and really maybe 3-4 seconds of difference in terms of lag.
Now, before we talk about your personal experience, and I do want to get into that, but there are three transformations that are taking place simultaneously, and the Michael Jackson Memorial, in some sense, was the perfect storm. The networks and the content providers have begun to resolve their intellectual property issues, which were an obstruction to some of this material being online. Secondly, broadband and the chips on your laptops are able to process a resolution of video as high as HD, and there's more availability of all of this stuff online, right?
That's correct.
So why did people in the networks come to Jesus on this issue and decide that, in fact, they don't have to protect their content and make everything subscription?
I think because they two major players, NBC and Fox, got together and launched Hulu. And I remember before Hulu launched, everyone said, it was a joke that, the big networks could never catch up with nimble little guys like YouTube and the streaming sites. But Hulu was surprisingly popular with younger generation and even, as time went on, even with a broader audience, just by having, a few new shows, especially shows that were not popular on the networks, like It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia and Rescue Me, which were two FX shows that, were probably not pulling more than a million an episode, but just became really surprisingly popular on there. And, I think it took off and people had to eat their words about what the networks could do when they got together, agreed to put their shows online and offer it in good quality with only a few commercials.
I know, but the way networks eat their words, you have like people like Jeff Zucker at NBC saying, we've now decided to do it, that somehow they're leading the edge, but they're not at all.
Right. I mean, NBC for a while was kind of hedging its bets with their own video site and also Hulu. But I think now they've seen that, just giving video to people straight up on the internet and with, just a tolerable level of sponsorship or commercials is going to work. People will watch it, whether at work or at home.
All right. Well, according to the TV ratings website, ZapToIt.com, MSNBC.com broke a single-day record with 19 million video streams on Tuesday during the memorial. CNN delivered about 10 million streams between noon and 5 p.m. These are huge numbers if we compare even to big Nielsen numbers of a generation ago. How does this transform the landscape? How do you deal with advertising? Where's all that going to go in this environment?
Well, I think it's right now it's a pretty as for the live streams, I guess I really didn't notice too much advertising in terms of video advertising as we're used to. You know, nothing from Charmin was popping in during the Michael Jackson tribute. But, you know, around the page, maybe some display advertising, which is its own kind of beast. I think that it's going to be interesting to see what they do in terms of how they present ads. It won't work the way it has with TV, where you can just throw in, 3 minutes every 7 minutes of advertising. I think you'll need to figure out ways to get people to sit down and watch, because with a laptop, unlike a TV, it's really easy to just walk away or open a browser and put it over the video while the commercial's rolling and check your email.
And anybody could do this. I mean, you can take the video stream from your laptop and put it on a big screen TV, right?
Yeah, most TVs that you're going to pull out of the box today, they have enough hookups in the back that you can get from your Mac or your PC and, over almost any kind of cable, $10 later in a few minutes, and you've definitely got a pretty good connection between your computer and your TV.
What about a remote? Do you have one?
I have one for my Apple TV, which is a very kind of gadgety device that not a lot of people
own. Tiny little white thing, yeah. It's so easy to lose.
Right, yeah, exactly. It's the same one that almost every MacBook and MacBook Pro come with these days. And it's just a little tiny remote, but, it's perfect for what you're going to use it for on the TV. Just, flipping channels or turn the volume up or down.
Well, so much changes, so much stays the same. Kevin Purdy, senior editor of lifehacker.com, talking about life after TV, getting all of your content from the internet online. We want to know your stories of leaving TV and the TV retro world that we live in. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And now all the headlines from the very retro Mark Garrison here in the studio.
Thank you, John. It's 29 minutes after the hour, and the UN boss says the G8 isn't doing enough on climate change. Ban Ki-moon says rich countries need to give more support to developing nations so they can cut pollution. More talks going on at the G8 with President Obama and other world leaders right now. Back in the States, L.A. is trying to get help paying a $1.4 million tab for securing the Michael Jackson Memorial. And South Korea says several websites in its country are currently under a new cyber attack. Earlier attacks slowed down or stopped multiple websites. Those are the headlines. John, what else is going on today?
And job claims down, retail sales down as well. That's the economic news. And up next, we've got an update on the Blagojevich prosecution. Very
always fertile ground.
Indeed.
Governor Rob Blago. I can't say it.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. So Patterson, Sanford, Palin, seems like there have been any number of governor dramas since Rod Blagojevich got into so much trouble. But there's an update in the Blagojevich story. John Harris, the former chief of staff for disgraced Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich, has pleaded guilty to fraud. Blagojevich, you may recall, is facing 16 counts of corruption, including extortion, racketeering, and lying to federal agents. With an update now, Rob Wildebor, criminal justice and courts reporter for WBEZ in Chicago, joins us. Good morning, Rob.
How you doing, John?
This plea of guilty to fraud by John Harris, the former chief of staff for Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich, does signal how the prosecution of the governor, the ex-governor, is going to go. Is he a witness who's turned, or are we talking about separate allegations, separate sort of corruptions? Is this a fundamentally separate prosecution or a separate deal, John Harris?
Oh, no. This is the guy who was arrested the same day as Blagojevich. And he's going to be able to shed light on a lot of basically what happened around the Senate seat. Prosecutors have charged Blagojevich with a number of different crimes, but the big one that got all the headlines, of course, was the allegations around how he dealt with the Senate vacancy when Obama won the presidency.
Well, Rob Wildeboer, criminal justice and courts reporter for WBEZ in Chicago, who of course reported the story, which originally was broken by federal prosecutors who arrested Rod Blagojevich, thinking that as governor he was trying to sell Barack Obama's vacant Senate seat, Barack Obama, of course, becoming president. So how does John Harris, the former chief of staff, bear on that particular element of this case?
Well, he really gives us – he'll be able to give us an inside view of what was going on. Of course, prosecutors already had thousands of recorded phone calls with the governor and other people allegedly scheming about this. There have been – this investigation has gone on for years and years, so there are previous investigations that were kind of little pieces of the puzzle, and they've been building towards an indictment of Blagojevich. But then Harris really was in the room with Blagojevich, and so he'll be able to say stuff like, oh, you know, we had this conversation on this day, and what I understood the governor to mean is X, Y, and Z, and the governor told me to do A, B, and C, and so then the next day I came back and told him I had done A, B, and C, and this is what the governor responded. So it'll really – you know, with these recordings that they have of the governor, you can always say, well, you know, we meant this or that. Harris will be able to say, well, no, this was our understanding, and this is what we did based on that understanding. And the other thing that Harris brings here is as you said, prosecutors brought the charges against Blagojevich kind of in the middle of this alleged scheme, before the Senate seat had been sold. So there was no real perfected crime here. So one of the things that a defendant could always say is, well, you know, we talked about it, but it was just talk. Harris will be able to say, you know, on this day, on Wednesday, he told me to do this in order to further the scheme. And on Thursday, I reported back to him and he told me to do this. So,
and of course, if he can indeed say that, I mean, the suspicion is if there's anybody who could say that, John Harris would be the only one, right?
Right. You know, the investigation's gone on a long time. So there have been a lot of people already who have pleaded guilty in this case. None of them co-defendants with Blagojevich, but people who have been related to this case in some way. Harris really gives us the first person that was in the room that's that close to it.
You know, let's talk a little bit about what's on the line for prosecutors, Rob. It seems to me that based on, first of all, Blagojevich's defense team, and he appears to have fairly formidable representation, but that plus what you just alluded to, that this arrest and this whole case, they intervened right in the middle. They didn't have a smoking gun. The Senate seat wasn't sold. Prosecutors probably aren't going to be able to convict Blagojevich on the Senate seat sale, are they? But they have to make a pretty good case that something like this was going on. They have to bring a lot of testimony into court on this issue to make it look like they have a really serious case here, and that all this that they created was worthwhile.
You know, they did bring this case earlier than they would have liked. But I don't know that they would have brought it if they didn't think they had the goods. This is an office that has like a 96% conviction rate. So if they bring charges, they've usually got a case pretty much in line. So I'm not sure if Harris is kind of the cherry on top here or if this was a part they really needed to fall in place, if they really needed Harris's testimony against the governor to make this case work for them. The one thing I think, you know, that is always a concern if you're a prosecutor is that, well, you know, maybe there's someone out there whose kid had a terrible illness and who was able to get health care because of a program Blagojevich implemented. If that person ends up on the jury, you know, wouldn't they want to repay Blagojevich in kind, like for saving their child's life? And so Harris kind of ensures that it just makes it a little tougher to for someone to find an out. If they wanted to find Blagojevich innocent, Harris makes it tougher for them to do so.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, talking about the jury pool there, do you really think they're going to have a difficult time? Or are there a lot of really sympathetic Blagojevich voters out there who might end up on this jury and cause problems for the prosecution?
I don't know that there are a lot, but of course all you need is one. And there are people out there who are sympathetic, and clearly Blagojevich thinks there are people out there sympathetic, and clearly he thinks he can maybe convince You know, as we've seen this public relations media campaign he's waged since being arrested, it seems that that's been a lot of that has been targeted at potentially sympathetic jurors.
So he's trying to turn the jury pool into either a no big deal, there's our governor out there, gosh, this is terrible, but he doesn't look so bad, or he helped me on health care or something like that, and I'll never vote against him. Finally, before we go, are there other Blagojevich staffers that might turn, that might be convictions or pleas of guilty and cooperating with the prosecution in the next few weeks?
Yeah, I don't know what the exact timeline will be because, of course, when you're talking about pleading guilty, you're working through all your testimony with the prosecutors and they want to know what you're going to say before they offer you a deal. And then you and your lawyer, you know, if you're the defendant, have to figure out, well, how much time are they willing to give us and is that worth us? You know, there's a whole negotiation
right.
process in terms of bringing down the sentence that prosecutors will agree to. So I don't know when it will be, but yeah, there is talk that Lon Monk, who is another former chief of staff to Blagojevich, is also talking about pleading guilty, and another top aide named John Wyma. So there are a couple more, and this is all on top of the people who have already been convicted or
sure.
pleaded guilty in kind of related cases and who are going to testify to certain aspects of the case. But again, Harris, who pleaded guilty yesterday, he'll be able to provide a larger narrative
fish.
and put it,
yeah.
put a lot of things in perspective because he's been the top aide from 2005 to 2008, so he's got a fairly long track record there.
Oh, great. When he's not speaking to us here on The Takeaway, Rob Wildeboer is a criminal justice and courts reporter for WBEZ in Chicago. Take care, Rob. And headlines now from Mark Garrison.
Thank you, John. 20 minutes before the hour, we've got several key economic reports just out this morning. New weekly jobless claims dropped sharply last week, but that was kind of a technical glitch. The other side of the coin is that continuing jobless claims are now at a record high. Also, the new retail sales report is out, showing continuing weakness across many types of stores. Job trouble's a big part of that. Also, the rainy weather. And Iran's security forces have dispersed hundreds of protesters in the streets of Tehran. The government promised a firm crackdown on any demonstrations after word got out that was happening today. John?
So coming up in 10 minutes, a look at the new Harry Potter film. That's in 10 minutes on The Takeaway. Thanks, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. The president is in Italy at the G8 summit today, but he meets with the Pope tomorrow, and then he'll head tomorrow also to Ghana, his first visit to sub-Saharan Africa as president, and a trip that carries very emotional and symbolic weight to Barack Obama, whose father is Kenyan, but it also carries the same weight across Africa and here in the United States. David Amanor, reporter for the BBC Network in Africa. He is Ghanaian and joins us from Accra in Ghana. David, thanks so much for being with us.
Hello, hi.
First of all, give us a sense of the anticipation among people in Ghana for the president's visit.
Yeah, well, this is a highly anticipated visit among everyday Ghanaians, of course, since it was announced back in May. Although there is excitement. There's plenty of excitement in Accra here in the capital about this visit. But I would say that it's tempered. It's probably been tempered by the recent rains, the heavy rains, which, of course, have on the roads. We've had some fuel shortages this week. So I think the excitement is tempered a bit by a bit of pessimism about the way things are and just the realization that perhaps the infrastructure, the quality of our infrastructure here in Ghana doesn't quite match the quality of praise we've been receiving for things such as democratic governance, those things which President Obama mentioned when he was asked why he chose Ghana.
Well, let's talk about the access. Are Ghanaians going to have much of an access to Barack Obama visually or otherwise on this trip? What's the security like?
Security, much of the security we understand is being handled by the United States apparatus. They've been very low key, mind you, you don't really notice it, but you get a sense that it's there. On top of that, the Ghanaian security has been beefed up. They're deploying 5,000 police officers from around the country in Accra and Caicos. As far as access goes, though, I think a lot of ordinary people are going to be disappointed, John, because whenever whenever you get a big event or a visit by a big visit by a head of state or somebody else, they usually come to a place known as Independence Square, where we have our own Liberty Arch, if you like, and that's where they would address the multitude. That's what Clinton did in 1998. This time, however, Barack Obama's stay in Accra, we're told he won't be going to Independence Square. We think it's because of security considerations. He'll instead address the Ghanaian parliament, which will be sitting at the International Conference Center, which is a very secure area. So as far as Accra goes, it's going to be a disappointment for a lot of people who really want to see him in the flesh.
Well, that's too bad, but part of the security probably relates to the anticipation. Yet, ironically, because George W. Bush was there in just February of last year and tripled foreign aid to Africa, you know, George W. Bush actually has a certain amount of popularity in Ghana as well as Barack Obama, yes?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and indeed, many people will still tell you that. I think George Bush put a lot more than any other U.S. president into Africa. And I think there's an acknowledgement here, especially in Ghana, where I think the electorate, you know, politically mature, there's an acknowledgement that actually Barack Obama isn't coming to give any more or to redeem Ghana, as one person on the street put it. So, you know, he has to look after American interests first. Whereas when George Bush came and I went out on the streets, there was lots of, we want George Bush to sort our drains, we want him to help, we need money, we need all this. I think it's interesting with Barack, there's a different attitude.
Well, David Amano, a reporter for BBC Network Africa, we can only hope that the president will get a better line out of Ghana than you have there. But thanks so much for joining us.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Some cross-generational anticipation of the new Harry Potter film coming up. But first, headlines from Mark Garrison.
Thank you, John. In Italy at the G8 summit, President Obama says there's still time to close the gap on disagreements between industrialized and more developing nations before a coming UN climate change meeting in December. Next up on his schedule, President Obama meets with Pope Benedict at the Vatican tomorrow. Back in the U.S., it could be out with the old and with the new with GM today. A deal that would turn General Motors into a mostly government-owned company is expected to close ahead of tomorrow's deadline.
Federal Motors, they're going to call it.
Federal Motors, yeah. American, I guess, was taken. We had one of those before. But a scientist known for cracking the genetic code and strong faith is President Obama's pick for a top medical post. Dr. Francis Collins is the nominee to head the National Institutes of Health.
You booked him yet?
No, we do have a request in, but we generally they don't talk until after all the Senate confirmation hearings and all that fun stuff. But we will see. We can check out his book, though. His book was The Language of God, A Scientist Presents Evidence for Belief. In Los Angeles, officials want someone to help pick up the tab for the $1.4 million the city spent on security for the Michael Jackson Memorial. Lots of police overtime was put in there. Also, we have new words in the dictionary. This is specifically the Merriam-Webster's Collegiate Dictionary.
Really?
All these really annoying portmanteaus like frenemies and staycation vlogs.
They're putting them in the dictionary?
They're actually going into the dictionary.
Oh,
now, there are some kind of
so
interesting
depressing.
Like cultural words like reggaeton, like the Puerto Rican hip-hop form, shawarma, things like that have become more common.
Well, shawarma is a real word.
Yeah, but it's now coming into the English dictionary like that.
No.
Staycation,
no,
that one totally kills me like that. The other thing, speaking of staycating or trying to vacate, the runway at JFK International Airport was shut down briefly because 78 turtles popped out and crawled onto the tarmac.
So. Al-Qaeda turtles or just regular turtles?
No confirmation they're connected with any terrorist groups, but they did. There were enough of them to block one runway for a good while.
Thank you, Mark Garrison.
You got it.
So the question for all of you around America anticipating the latest installment of the Harry Potter series is, can the world allow Harry Potter to grow up? Professor Dumbledore has an answer.
What you are looking at are memories. In this case, pertaining to one individual, Voldemort, or as it was known then, Tom Riddle. This vial contains the most particular memory of the day I first met him. I'd like you to see it, if you would.
from the next Harry Potter movie. It's the dramatization of Book 7 in the series, wide release next week on July 15th. Here in New York, there was a premiere. David Edelstein was there, chief film critic for New York Magazine. Also with us is Preeti Vaidyanathan, a Harry Potter fan in Ontario, Canada. Good morning, Preeti.
Good morning.
And how old were you when you read your first Harry Potter book?
Oh, I must have been in grade 6, so I was about 11 years old, I guess.
And how old were you when you saw the first movie?
I would have seen it on opening day, so whenever it came out, I guess.
The very first movie, yeah. Right. So, but it was a long time ago, right? You're 21 years old now, right?
Yeah, it's
okay.
Been a while.
So, David Edelstein, we gathered you and Preeti here to talk a little bit about the generational shift. There are movies that have generational changes over the course of their lifespan, their various installments. But Harry Potter is unique, it seems to me. Who is this movie for, David?
Well, I think this movie is for everyone. In the beginning, it was for everyone who loves that whole genre of prep school movies where you see little kids coming in and then learning, you know, the horrific ways of the world, but at the same time having their own weird idiosyncrasies affirmed. So all of us, really, back then.
And my girls, I have two 11-year-olds. You have an 11-year-old, right?
I have an 11-year-old girl.
They have actually planned a whole outing with their 11-year-old friends to go and see. Actually, they'll be 10. They will literally be 10 at the time they go to see this next week. The premiere happens tonight, Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. Is this a movie for 10 and 11-year-olds? I mean, certainly the books are for kids as young as, you know, fourth, fifth grade.
It horrifies me what my 11-year-old daughter has seen that I would have no idea even existed when I'd been her age. But so I think you can get away with it. Yeah, I think you can. It's the one thing I will say is tell them to go to the bathroom beforehand, because this is
a long movie.
This is another one of these movies that hits the 2-hour and 30-minute mark. And you really, don't get the industrial sized Diet Coke and expect to stay in your seat the whole time.
Good advice. So Preeti Vaidyanathan, 21 years old from University of Waterloo, how annoying is it to listen to two 50-year-olds talk about their 10-year-olds going to the Harry Potter movie?
Well, I'll be seeing that movie too, so probably in that age group, even though I'm 21.
So why are you going to see this movie?
I followed the books since they first came out. Like, I go the day the book was released to the bookstore to get it. So even when the movies came out, I always saw them. So I'll definitely keep on seeing this one and the next movie when it comes out to finish the whole series.
The day it was released? The day it was released? Because I got you beat. I was there at 12:01 a.m. The morning the last one was released. Were you there at any of those parties?
Yeah, for the last book, my friends and I, it was during our exam time, but we all went anyway to the bookstore and sat. All the kids were dressed up and we lined up to get our book, and then we didn't study for exams. Instead, we read the book for 2 days straight.
Wow.
Studying, so.
So you didn't see her because she was in disguise, David. I think that's the key. Yeah, David Edelstein, chief film critic for the New York Magazine, and Preeti Vaidyanathan, a Harry Potter fan at the University of Waterloo in Ontario. You know, some have said, Preeti, that the sequel to Harry Potter is actually Twilight. For your age, Twilight is more targeted for your group.
Okay. I saw the movie, actually, and I think if I was still in high school, I would definitely read the book, but right now I can't see myself picking up and reading that book.
How influential was the Harry Potter series in how much you read today? And I suspect you're reading a lot to get through college.
Yeah, definitely. I used to read a lot more when I was, like, around that time when Harry Potter came out. I'd read a lot of fantasy books, so it definitely encouraged me to read more. And a lot of my friends would also be reading the books, so we'd talk about it and go online and find the spoilers and stuff when the books weren't all released yet. But, yeah, now I'm reading a lot of non-fiction literature, unfortunately.
Well, I imagine the skill of being able to sit, you know, finish an 800-page book on Harry Potter helps you when you're doing organic chemistry. David Edelstein, how influential have the Harry Potter books been on your kids, and what do you think of this movie?
Well, first of all, I don't know that it has been as influential maybe as Twilight has been just
really?
In a very short time. Twilight is about sex, or it's about repressed sex and sublimated sex, and I don't know, kids seem much more interested in that. Even just since the Harry Potter series has begun, the boundary posts have moved a little bit in terms of kids' culture, I think. And now, as for this movie,
I didn't really expect to love it because I think Harry Potter at this point seems so 2007. You know, we know how it ends.
Right.
We've read that. Many of us have read the last installment. The end is a little lame, but, you know, it's exciting. It's well wrapped up. So I didn't expect to like it. I really loved it. I had a great time.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah.
So my girls will have a great time when they go.
I think so. I think it's been really, unlike the first installments of the movie series, which I think were written and directed by people on their knees, over-reverent, I think that this movie has really been thought out in terms of a story on film. And it's just a wonderful piece of storytelling and filmmaking.
And, you know, what we've learned in some of these serialized movie series, like Star Wars, if people love the series, they'll even go to the unwatchable ones. And the Star Wars, the later Star Wars ones were completely unwatchable. Well, Priti, this is getting a really good review, this new Harry Potter movie. Is it actually a worry, do you think, of the film directors that you folks, just like Harry Potter, grow up and leave your youthful Harry Potter notions behind?
I think they would definitely consider it, but I think they really have us hooked. Like, there's no way I wouldn't see the next movie. Even if everyone said it was awful, I would still go and see it. So,
don't you want to see how these kids look now that they're approaching 20s? They're of legal age.
We've had a couple of Dumbledores already, right?
Yes, we have, and actually Dumbledore, the relationship between Harry and Dumbledore is really the core of this film, I think, in a lot of ways.
Oh, great stuff. The Harry Potter premiere tonight here in New York City. David Edelstein gives it a rave. He's the chief film critic for New York Magazine. Films open in wide distribution around the United States and North America next week. Priti Vaidyanathan will be there, Harry Potter fan, 21 years old at the University of Waterloo. Priti, don't skip any exams this time, okay? Another event, the Michael Jackson Memorial, the Obama inauguration, both were watched online by a huge audience. And suddenly, as we were talking about this hour, maybe the traditional TV looks a little retro. Here's what you had to say.
Yeah, I'm a TV junkie and also aspiring TV writer. But how I do it, I'm a Hulu junkie. I also belong to over 161 public libraries by which I can borrow TV collections. Yeah, you can live without TV, and especially if you can't afford cable like I am.
This is Seth from Hoboken. The TV is the centerpiece of the American living room. And until a computer can take that spot in the living room, then people will continue to watch the tube.
Tell us your retro TV stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org, where the conversation continues online. We're always on at thetakeaway.org. You can subscribe to our podcast at thetakeaway.org. If you've smashed your TV, send us a picture of that as well. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.